You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to our colleagues at WisContext about their new story looking at white nose syndrome in bats 5 years after the disease was spotted here in Wisconsin. First, if you want to avoid Lyme disease, the state-of-the-art prevention involves tucking our pants into our socks when we spend time in the woods, doing tick checks afterward, and having plenty of DEET on hand. A vaccine, for humans, though, has been tougher to develop. A human Lyme vaccine was available about 20 years ago, but it was taken off the market after concerns over possible side effects. Now, a French biotech company is hoping to avoid those pitfalls with a new version of a Lyme vaccine currently going through phase 2 clinical trials in the U.S. Cassandra Williard is a freelance science journalist based in Madison. She recently wrote about Lyme disease vaccines for Undark magazine. Cassandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, before we talk about the latest research on Lyme vaccines, how big a deal would it be for us to have an actual functioning human vaccine?
I think it would be a really big deal. Lyme disease is something that has grown in prevalence over the years, and we certainly know that in the Midwest it's a big problem here and also in the Northeast. So it would be a real public health win to have a vaccine.
Do I have this right? We can use a vaccine for our dogs, just not for ourselves, our humans.
Right. Yeah, that's right. You can go and get your dog vaccinated for Lyme disease, but there is nothing on the market for humans right now.
Back in the earlier days of Lyme disease, you write, there was this human Lyme disease vaccine. People could get it. It was called Lymerix. Can you talk about how this thing actually worked?
Yeah, so it had a really kind of interesting mechanism of action. It went after this protein on the surface of the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. It was a protein called outer surface protein A. And so when the vaccine would have you generate antibodies against this protein, and then when the tick would feed on you or someone who'd been immunized, it would ingest the blood that had these antibodies in it, and then the antibodies would actually go after the bacteria inside the tick. So it would kill the bacteria in the tick's gut before it ever even could get to you.
Talk about the rise and fall of Lymerix. Why did it end up getting taken off the market?
Yeah, so Lymerix has an interesting backstory in that it was approved in late 1998. And even when it was just first being approved, there were already some sort of safety concerns. So there was this idea that there was some scientific literature that suggested that there was that OspA, which was the protein in the vaccine, looked an awful lot like a human protein. And there was this concern that perhaps if you were getting your body to generate antibodies against OspA, that these antibodies might get confused and mistakenly attack the human protein instead. So there was this concern about autoimmune disease. And so it kind of like went to market with a pall over it already. And then, you know, pretty much immediately people were reporting side effects, and there were complaints about side effects, mostly things like arthritis. And there was never any evidence from large scale studies that this was actually true. You know, the FDA looked into this once it had been on the market for, I don't know, a year or two. And they looked at the prevalence of arthritis among people who had been vaccinated versus, you know, unvaccinated individuals, and they didn't see a difference. But it really just, it cast a pall over the whole thing. And then there was a class action lawsuit filed. And so the company just voluntarily withdrew the vaccine because of they weren't making money on it.
Here we are 20 years later. It seems like there would be demand for research into a new Lyme vaccine. Did that initial reaction to Lymerix and it getting taken off the market kind of make other drug companies say, maybe we shouldn't rush into this?
Yes, very much so. There have not been a lot of companies that have been willing to sort of go after Lyme disease or go after a Lyme disease vaccine. So Valneva 6 years ago started developing this one they've got in clinical trials right now, and they're kind of out there alone.
Talking to Cassandra Williard, freelance science journalist based in Madison, looking at the long-term quest for a vaccine for humans to not get Lyme disease. Cassandra, talk more about this new effort to this biotech company. What are they trying to do differently from Lymerix to, they would hope, avoid the same concerns?
Yeah, so the vaccine is slightly different than Lymerix was. It should work. Lymerix only worked in the U.S. against the sort of U.S. form of Lyme disease. And this new vaccine they're developing should work in Europe as well. And so that's one benefit. And then also they, out of an abundance of caution, have removed this sort of problematic piece of the protein that was sort of mimicking the human protein. Not because they think that it caused any harm in Lymerix, but just because sort of the public relations aspect of it. They thought it would just be, you know, better to not have it in there.
And something you just said, I didn't realize there are different strains, different regional strains of Lyme disease to where a vaccine might work in the U.S. but not in Europe.
Right. Yeah. So they're caused by different bacteria or different strains of the bacteria. So they all have slightly different outer surface proteins. So if you wanted to develop one that was going to work in multiple locations, then you need those different sort of forms of OSPA.
You write that even if clinical trials go swimmingly by this biotech company, they still need a partner, a drug company partner, to get it to market. What are some of the hurdles there?
Yeah, I mean, I think companies are really wary. There's not, you know, they're also tight-lipped, so there may be efforts that are going on that I don't know about. But I think the drug companies are feeling like, you know, we saw what happened with Lymerix, and is demand really going to be enough now to sort of overcome the challenges? And I think there's also, you know, a feeling of there's a feeling among Lyme activists that that they were never really heard regarding the potential side of effects of Lymerix. So I think there's this feeling that, like, they felt like there was real harm done by Lymerix, and they never got a satisfying answer as to why that was or what went wrong with the vaccine. And so for there to be now efforts to develop a new vaccine, I think they're sort of feeling like, why didn't we ever get an answer to what happened with the old one?
And is that in turn going to make drug companies maybe even a little more nervous about diving into something like this? So we've got skepticism about proven vaccines like the measles vaccine, for example, controversy over Lyme disease and chronic Lyme. Are companies just not going to want to go there?
I mean, some companies probably are not going to want to go there. Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. One sort of advantage with Lyme disease, you know, there is an anti-vax movement for sure, but it's not like measles where, like, you know, we need to maintain sort of herd immunity to protect everyone against measles. Lyme doesn't really work that way. So you can make an individual choice about whether you're going to get the Lyme vaccine or not, and not really be putting anyone else in harm's way.
Even in the best case scenario, the tests for this Lyme vaccine work great. A drug company partner says, yep, we're on board. How long would it take to get from where we are now to people being able to buy this and take it, get the vaccine before hiking?
Well, Neva thinks it's about 5 years from seeking approval.
And
can
you talk about, at least from what we know now, what it would take? It sounds like this isn't just get one shot and you're set for life.
Yeah, I mean, with Lymerix, it was multiple shots, and it, you know, it wasn't a perfect vaccine. You had about 75% protection. The vaccine from Valneva is going to be similar. We don't know what the efficacy will be yet because they haven't done those studies, but it's also probably going to be multiple shots. So it's, again, not going to be a perfect vaccine. And then the other consideration is that it will protect against Lyme, we think. But it's not going to protect against other things that ticks would carry, like babesiosis or some of the other tick-borne diseases.
Cassandra, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Cassandra Williard, a freelance science journalist based in Madison. She was with us to talk about the past and possible future of a human Lyme disease vaccine. Coming up, we'll look at a new report about bats in Wisconsin and check in on a fatal disease that's been affecting bat populations across the country. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a White House security official and Ukraine expert testified yesterday as part of the impeachment inquiry, and a House vote on inquiry procedures is planned for tomorrow. A Capitol Hill reporter will help us get caught up. First, Halloween is tomorrow, and on top of all the normal fun, it also marks the end of International Bat Week. The week celebrates the role that bats play in their ecosystem. But in North America, bat populations have continued to suffer from a fatal disease called white nose syndrome. It was first spotted in Wisconsin about 5 years ago, and our colleagues at WisContext have been looking at how it's progressed in the state since then. Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez talked about it with WisContext associate editor Will Cushman earlier today.
Well, remind us what white nose syndrome is and how it affects bats.
Sure. Yeah, white nose syndrome is the term described, or the term that scientists use to describe this disease in bats that's caused by a fungus. It's an invasive fungus. It comes from Eurasia, scientists are pretty sure. And it appeared in New York State in 2006 in bats around in caves around Albany, New York. And it since then has spread west across pretty much all of eastern North America. It made its way to Wisconsin in 2014. The fungus is called Pseudogymnoscus destructens. Hopefully I pronounced that pretty accurately. But yeah, destructens was the term that scientists landed on because of its really destructive power. It has really decimated the populations of several bat species across North America, including in Wisconsin.
And do we know, we mentioned that we're about 5 years into understanding that it's here in Wisconsin too. Do we know how big of an effect it has had on bat populations here?
Yeah, it's had a major effect on several species. One of those species is the little brown bat. So there's little brown bats and big brown bats. There's four species in Wisconsin that hibernate in caves. And it's those species that are affected by white nose syndrome because the fungus that causes the disease grows really well in cold environments like the caves that bats hibernate in. And little brown bats and big brown bats are two of those species. Little brown bats have been affected pretty significantly. Big brown bats, not as much. Scientists believe that is partially because of their habits. Big brown bats are more likely to hibernate in buildings than little brown bats or other hibernating species. So they might just not come into contact with this fungus as much. And then there's a couple other species, the northern long-eared bat and the tricolored bat, which have also been significantly impacted. And the northern long-eared bat, in particular, scientists are using the word potential extinction when talking about that bat, not just in Wisconsin, but across North America.
And there are some bats, from reading your piece, that have at least not been affected as much, right, along rivers in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. Even little brown bats, which have generally been found to be significantly impacted by white nose syndrome, to the point where, like, there is the initial site where white nose syndrome was discovered in Wisconsin, in Grant County in the southwest part of the state. That site included historically up to 1,000 bats, and most of those being little brown bats. And within 4 years of the fungus's discovery there, so by 2018, there were only 9 bats hibernating there versus the historical average of 1,000. But yeah, you're right. There are some. They're called hibernacula. That's a technical term for sites where bats hibernate, which in Wisconsin includes caves. It also includes abandoned mine shafts. There's a lot of old lead mining shafts left over from the 19th century, especially in the southwest part of the state where bats hibernate. And then also buildings. But yeah, there are a couple sites along the Mississippi River and the Wisconsin River where these little brown bats, for some reason, are able to persist in relatively high numbers. The DNR and scientists are trying to kind of figure out why that is, because they think the hope is that if they can figure out why certain populations are able to persist, that they could potentially help out other populations elsewhere.
And you mentioned this fungus that researchers are now thinking is linked to white nose syndrome. They didn't always think that it was linked, right?
Yeah, initially, this was really interesting. I talked to a microbiologist at the National Wildlife Health Center here in Madison. It's a USGS center, so it's the United States Geological Survey. His name is Jeff Lorch, and he did his PhD work at UW-Madison around the time that white nose syndrome was appearing out east in New York State and then expanding. And the focus of his PhD work was largely trying to figure out like what was involved in white nose syndrome and how this fungus could be so destructive. And he said, yeah, that in the beginning there was quite a bit of debate in the scientific community about whether or not this fungus was actually causing the disease or was maybe just a symptom of some other disease or some environmental issue that was impacting the bats. But some of the work that Jeff did was pretty definitive in identifying that specific fungus as the causative agent, the reason behind this disease.
We're talking to Will Cushman, an associate editor at WisContext, about bats and white nose syndrome, now that we're about 5 years after the disease was discovered in Wisconsin. And Will, one of the other strange parts of this disease is that it sounds like the fungus doesn't have an effect on bats in Europe or Asia, right? Just in North America?
Yeah, and so that's one of the things that scientists are trying to figure out, like why. It's definitely an invasive fungus, so it does not occur or historically had not occurred naturally in North America. So the thought is that North American bats didn't co-evolve with this fungus, were not exposed to this fungus before, like their Eurasian counterparts had been for a long time. Scientists still don't understand exactly why Eurasian bats aren't susceptible to the fungus, but the fact that it's invasive here in North America, I think, is a pretty significant clue.
The researcher that you mentioned, Jeff Lorch, he now works at a place called the National Wildlife Health Center, and that's right here in Madison. What's their role in all of this?
They have a really pretty significant role nationally. I had no idea that this center existed in Madison until I started reporting on the story this summer. And yeah, the center is on the west side of Madison, and they have a nationally significant role in identifying and studying all sorts of wildlife diseases. And so because of that, the center received specimens of dead bats, like going back to the very beginning in 2006 when they were 2006, 2007, when they were first found dead in New York State. The center here in Madison received samples, and it was scientists here in Madison, along with colleagues elsewhere in the country, but headed up by scientists here at that center in Madison, who first identified and described the fungus that causes white nose syndrome. So I thought that was a really interesting and fascinating part of the story that I think a lot of people in Madison and Wisconsin don't know.
Yeah, and I know that you've got a couple more stories coming out on this, one related to a lot of the volunteer efforts around this issue.
Yeah. So the DNR has been super proactive in the face of white nose syndrome since before it was found here in the state in 2014. I think pretty soon after white nose syndrome was discovered in New York and after scientists and conservation biologists, wildlife managers all across the country started realizing that this was a really big problem and it was likely not going to remain in New York on the East Coast, the Wisconsin DNR really became proactive and started counting bats using all sorts of different methods. I shouldn't say that they started, but they really ramped up their efforts. And a lot of those efforts include really dedicated and enthusiastic volunteers, so citizen scientists who participate in, for instance, the Great Wisconsin Bat Count every summer, where volunteers, hundreds of volunteers, go to known bat roosting sites all over the state and count bats as they leave their roosts. They do that twice a year, once before pups can fly and once after pups can fly. And there are all sorts of other efforts that the National Park Service is involved in up at the Apostle Islands. So, yeah, I'm going to get into those efforts. I think they're really fascinating and a kind of optimistic part of the story.
Awesome. And in our last few minutes, I know you've got one more story looking at efforts to find a vaccine for white nose. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was also really interesting and involved scientists at the National Wildlife Health Center. They're working with researchers at UW-Madison to develop, potentially a vaccine for white nose syndrome. This is a huge challenge because fungal vaccines are really difficult to develop in the first place for any species, for humans even. And then trying to, even if they are successful, they're actually onto a pretty promising potential vaccine. But even if they get to the point where they think that they can deploy it in the field, actually being able to deploy this vaccine will be logistically very, very challenging.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for those. Thanks so much, Will.
Thank you.
That was Will Cushman, Associate Editor for WisContext, talking to Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez. If you want to read more about their reporting on white nose syndrome and other bat-related topics, you can find that online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, lawmakers heard yesterday from the first current White House official to testify in the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. We'll find out what they learned and what's next in the process. That's part of our weekly roundup of the top stories in the world of national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to an education reporter about new data that shows Wisconsin's racial achievement gap is the biggest of all 50 states for the second time in less than a decade. First, we're getting caught up on the week in Washington. The House impeachment inquiry rolls on. Yesterday, lawmakers heard from a White House official who listened in to President Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is planning a vote to formalize the rules of the inquiry. And meanwhile, Senate Republicans were signing on this week to a resolution condemning the early stages of the impeachment process. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on all this. What do you make of the statements and testimony about President Trump's handling of military aid to Ukraine, requests for investigations in that country? What concerns you? What are you watching for? Do you have worries about how the process is playing out? What do you want to come out of all of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good to be back with you.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the first current White House official, as I understand it, who listened to the July 25th call to testify in the impeachment inquiry, so a firsthand report there. He raised concerns about that call at the time and in this hearing yesterday. What jumps out to you about this?
I mean, you hit the nail on the head. He is the first person to be deposed by congressional investigators who had firsthand knowledge, who was actually one of these dozens of people who was on the July 25th phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian President Zelensky. He heard exactly what the president said and raised concerns about this potential quid pro quo, where the president and many of his allies were trying to extract political favors, pressure Zelensky to conduct politically motivated investigations into Joe Biden, among other folks. And so, you know, in my opinion, and what we're hearing from many Democrats coming out of that hearing and deposition is that so far that has been the most damaging testimony to date, because this individual, a respected Purple Heart recipient, Army veteran from the Iraq War, you know, is saying that he raised and was sounding the alarm bells and took it up the chain to his up the chain of command and had serious concerns.
One objection that's been raised to previous testimony by the president and some Republicans is that, well, this is hearsay. We're not getting firsthand accounts of things like this phone call. Is this something that stops that line of attack?
I think so. And, you know, the president has referred to this individual, Mr. Vindman, as unpatriotic and a traitor. And you saw some Republican leaders, including Liz Cheney, who runs the messaging operation out of the House Republican Conference. And she said, we need to stop the attacks on this decorated war veteran. That will not stand. He is doing his service and providing a testimony to the best of his knowledge, and we should not be attacking him. And that seemed to quieted the criticism from the Republican side, although they're still complaining about process.
We'll get into the process concerns in just a minute. We have this partial transcript from the White House on that July 25th phone call. Did we hear anything from Lieutenant Colonel Vindman that adds to what we know about what's in that transcript and what's not in it?
Well, what I would say is that, you know, one of the big takeaways is that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman seemed to contradict testimony from Ambassador Gordon Sondland. He's the ambassador to the EU, who had come before congressional investigators and told them that he had not really taken part in any of this pressure campaign against the Ukraine to try to extract these politically motivated investigations. Vindman said that Sondland was, in fact, a big part of that, and that was also something we heard in previous testimony from Bill Taylor. And so a lot of the focus now has been turned on Ambassador Sondland. He was a Trump donor during the 2016 campaign, won a key ambassadorship to the EU. And now there are Democrats, including Congressman Castro, who have said, you know, to me, this sounds like perjury, and we need to call Sondland back to the committee and have him clarify some of these statements. Otherwise, we're going to have to refer Sondland to the DOJ for perjury.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at the big news in national politics, talking about the impeachment inquiry for a good while now. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. You mentioned the procedural side of things, Scott, and a vote expected tomorrow in the House. What is being voted on?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a murky issue. You know, Democrats had been under pressure from Republicans for holding these hearings and depositions behind closed doors. And President Trump and Republicans had raised significant concerns about that. And so this vote is coming, it would seem, in reaction to that. However, Nancy Pelosi is saying that what essentially this is a vote to lay out the ground rules and the framework for what happens next in the public portion of these hearings. And so we've had several weeks now of closed door hearings, private hearings, where we haven't really seen and heard too much about what's going on behind closed doors. That's going to now start to move out into the public before the television cameras, sort of like the Watergate hearings in the 70s. And so Pelosi is saying that we need rules for how this will be all governed. And so they're laying out some of these policies and procedures for what that's going to look like.
Now, those closed-door meetings were three key House committees. The Democrats and the Republicans on those committees could participate, right?
That's right. And we are going to see, you know, one interesting facet of the public hearings based on this resolution is that we are going to see 45 minutes for each hearing uninterrupted of Democratic questioning, and then 45 minutes of Republican questioning. The chairman could use that 45 minutes, but they could also defer to some of their staff counsel, who obviously are much more professional and experienced in how to depose or question a witness. And then after those 90 minutes, it's going to move to what we normally see on C-SPAN and other cable news outlets, where the lawmakers get an opportunity to question. So that's something that's going to be a little different than what we've seen in past congressional hearings.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ned is with us in Watersmeet, Michigan. Ned, hi.
Hi there. Just wanted to know exactly what crimes could be committed with this conversation. I mean, it was all released. And if we do, just say worst-case scenario, what do you expect to get from this?
Ned, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, there aren't articles of impeachment drawn up yet, right? That would be kind of the penultimate step before voting on it after this inquiry. Do I have that right?
That's right. And the resolution sort of addresses that and lays out that it will be the Intelligence Committee and Chairman Schiff who will be leading the public portion, at least, of the impeachment inquiry that will be in the public, focused on the Ukraine matter. And then it talks about, the resolution talks about how recommendations will be sent to the Judiciary Committee, and Jerry Nadler, the chairman there, who will then draft the actual articles of impeachment that will head to the House floor and receive a vote. Now, we're hearing a little bit about some possibilities, and obviously their broad obstruction of justice and obstruction of Congress is one, because some of the White House officials and other administration officials have refused to show up for their depositions. And so that is one aspect of this that could be an article of impeachment. Also, abuse of power, the president, allegations that the president used his office to try to compel a foreign government to conduct a politically motivated investigation while withholding publicly funded military or national security aid for the Ukraine. That could be another article of impeachment. There's no telling how many we will see, but those are at least two we're hearing about.
On that issue of why witnesses aren't being allowed to come forward, I want to give a listen to House Intelligence Committee Chair Democrat Adam Schiff talking about Republican resistance to parts of the inquiry earlier this week.
I can understand why the president doesn't want these witnesses to come forward. What I find harder to understand is why the Republican members of this body in this House don't want these witnesses to come forward. Where is their duty to this institution? Where is their duty to the Constitution?
So part of the back and forth over the process and procedure here, do you expect to see more resistance to people coming forward and testifying as we hit the public stage of this now, Scott?
It's hard to say. They've actually, we have a few more witnesses to get through in the private portion of this. They've just called the Intelligence Committee, and the three committees have just called John Bolton to testify just a little less than an hour ago to testify next week on November 7th. That's going to be if he decides to show up, and he has plenty of reasons to want to talk. Because he raised concerns about the Ukraine quid pro quo as well to some of these other players in this saga. And so it'll be interesting to see whether he decides to show up on his own. We are seeing, even though the administration and the White House has made clear to their people they do not want them to show up at these depositions, many are deciding to come anyway, and it's been very interesting to see. And there's no real clear pattern as to who's deciding to show up and who's deciding not to show up, but it's been very interesting when some of these officials talking about their sense of duty and patriotism are deciding to testify and tell the truth to their best ability.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, about the latest in the impeachment inquiry and other top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What stood out to you in the testimonies and statements we've heard about so far in the inquiry? Are you looking forward to the public part of this, seeing people testify on TV in public? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the week's top political news. Also on the issue of impeachment, Scott, in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, ally of President Trump, introduced a resolution condemning the impeachment inquiry. Here's a listen to him talking about that this week.
The Senate should be letting the House know that if you're going to continue this kind of process and it results in articles of impeachment, we do not consider this, in my view, I consider it to be out of bounds with what we've done in the past, void of basic due process.
Scott, it sounds like that resolution may not go forward. What's the latest?
Yeah, you know, this resolution was rolled out in a press conference with Lindsey Graham and the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell the other day. And since then, Nancy Pelosi, as we know and we're discussing earlier, have moved forward with this Thursday vote on their own impeachment resolution that talks about what the process will look like as it heads into the public portion of this investigation. And so it sort of undercuts the complaint from Graham and McConnell that this is all being done in private, when now Nancy Pelosi is laying out exactly what the public hearings will look like in the House of Representatives.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What stands out to me in this whole process is the mainstream media bias that continues, including Wisconsin Public Radio, saying things like, you know, the impeachment is going forward, and how do you feel when we see these hearings? Nothing has actually happened yet. It's like selling a car and saying, how's it going to feel when you're in the back seat? Well, you know, these are very serious political questions, and my belief, what stands out to me, is how the evidence that Rudy Giuliani found of corruption from Biden, that's what led to this whole conversation, which led to the phone call, and that's what led to the president choosing to investigate a corrupt act by a former Democratic vice president. That's what started it all.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call, and that's the case that many Republicans are trying to make here, Scott.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think there are even some Democrats that will say, look, the Biden sweetheart deal that he had with the Ukrainian oil company,
Hunter Biden, the son,
does not look good. It doesn't really pass the smell test. The question is, was it illegal? It doesn't appear that, as far as we know so far, and that, believe me, plenty of reporters are digging, it doesn't appear that there was anything illegal to that arrangement. But, Republicans certainly do have a point that, you know, Hunter Biden did not have a whole lot of experience in the energy sector. Clearly, his father was vice president at the time. And Hunter Biden, in a TV interview not too long ago, acknowledged that if his name was not Biden, he probably would not have gotten that deal. That being said, you know, there's still this separate issue with the president, while dangling $400 million of taxpayer-funded military aid over Ukraine while demanding, investigations into his chief political rival, whether that was appropriate or even unconstitutional. And so, these are the two arguments that we're hearing right now.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in Washington this week. Well, let's step aside for a few from impeachment, Scott, and take you back to your old beat. You used to cover Paul Ryan of Wisconsin when he was House Speaker, and you are covering his announcement launching a nonprofit called the American Idea Foundation. What's that all about?
Yeah, Speaker Ryan just rolled out his own nonprofit called the American Idea Foundation, which will have some offices back in Janesville, and will also, I assume, have offices in Washington, D.C., but it's going to focus on some of the issues that he had been fighting for while during his 20 years in Congress, you know, anti-poverty measures, you know, boosting economic opportunity for people, something he calls, you know, promoting evidence-based reforms on things like welfare and criminal justice. And so this is a continuation, I think, of his work in Congress. He's also been keeping busy in many other ways. He joined the board of Fox Corporation, which oversees Fox News. He's been doing guest lecturing at the University of Notre Dame, and has been joining the speaking circuit, getting paid quite handsomely, I would expect, giving speeches all across the country.
And he made some waves after some comments in an interview, I think it was with Tim Alberta, in his book American Carnage, about President Trump. What did we hear there?
Yeah, I don't have the exact quote in front of me here, but he has, as you know and I know, been critical of the president, not only on the 2016 campaign trail where they clashed multiple times over the president's language and some of the president's actions, but also during the time when he was, when Ryan was speaker and Trump was in the White House. And so this has been sort of a hot cold relationship. I think they finally figured out how to get along, but the Speaker Ryan said in the Alberta book that there were many, many moments where it required him and other sort of adults in the room to steer President Trump in the right direction and help him get to the best decision. And I don't think the president took very kindly to those remarks.
And finally, we'll be watching Senate elections in 2020, and you're looking, and a lot of people are looking, at what happens in Alabama. We had Doug Jones, a Democrat, win a state that's almost always won by Republicans after Roy Moore won the Republican nomination. There's a big name now getting into that race, potentially. Who's out there?
Well, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who I know very well and used to cover in the Senate, has been calling his former congressional delegation of Alabama in the House of Representatives and sort of putting out feelers, you know, saying things like, what would you think or what would you feel if I were to jump into this very crowded Senate race? This was the Senate seat that he held from 1997 to 2017 before Trump picked him as his first attorney general. It's causing quite a bit of waves in that election and in that race. One of the people who got a call from Sessions is Congressman Bradley Byrne, who essentially has publicly warned Sessions that, look, Trump does not like you. He did not care that you recused yourself in the Russia investigation and created 2 years of headaches for the Trump administration, and will not be very supportive of you if you decide to run, essentially firing a warning shot and trying to urge Sessions not to jump into this race. Bradley Byrne looks like he's the front runner at this point, but there's also some other names, former Auburn coach, football coach Tommy Tuberville among them. And so it's a fascinating race. Oh, also Roy Moore, who lost to Doug Jones after facing sexual assault and sexual harassment allegations in that 2017 special election.
Briefly, Scott, Republicans are defending a lot of Senate seats in 2020. This Alabama is one of their biggest hopes to pick one back up from Democrats, right?
I think so, and I think if they do nominate somebody like Bradley Byrne or Tommy Tuberville or even Jeff Sessions, for that matter, they probably will take that seat back. It is a deep red state that President Trump is extremely popular. And so I think out of all of those Senate seats, that probably is the prime pickup opportunity for Republicans.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much, Rob.
We've been talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He joined us for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. You can still let us know what you think about the latest developments in the impeachment inquiry. Are you hoping to see more public testimonies now? Do you think the inquiry should proceed at all? Are you hoping the House votes to impeach or not? And then what would you want to see come out of the Senate? And what parts of the process do you want to hear us talk about more? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can always email ideas@WPR.org. Looking for a unique holiday getaway this year? A Chicago hotel is offering a Home Alone-themed experience, complete with snacks and decorations inspired by the 1990 movie, and of course DVD copies of Home Alone and Home Alone 2. Home Alone is one of the, what, eight movies producer Bill Martin has seen in his life. Bill, hey.
Eight or nine, something like that, yeah.
Does this sound like fun to you, a Home Alone-themed hotel experience?
I like the idea. And I'm kind of inclined to go check it out. However, I just kind of wonder if I'd be setting the bar, my expectations way too high.
Right. You love this movie.
One and two. The original is the best. But I'd be afraid that I would, you know, leave disappointed.
Yeah. I mean, if you could have polka music provided by John Candy, the late John Candy's band in the movie.
Naturally.
That would be great.
Right.
That would add to it. I didn't see anything about that.
I didn't see anything in there. I guess you'd bring your own polka.
And also, are you getting the Macaulay Culkin part of the experience or the Joe Pesci and Bruce Dern part of the experience? Because if you're paying for that,
A whole different
make
game.
Make sure you fill out the health insurance check, beforehand.
Paint can in the face? Yes, please.
No, thanks. So this is at a hotel, though. I mean, in Home Alone 2, he stayed in a New York hotel at some point. Is that right?
He did. Yeah, it was. I should know this. I forget the name of it. One of the big fancy hotels there. And in that scene, you know who's in there?
Right,
President Trump,
the current president of the United States, was in Home Alone 2.
I don't know if he's in this thing in Illinois or what. But
Home Alone 1, you're supposed to be in a home.
True. Yeah,
Hotel Alone featuring Bill Martin's. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.